A quick word from our sponsor, Freed. We all want a more efficient workflow, and Freed is an AI scribe that helps with just that. Freed AI not only listens, it transcribes and writes your medical documentation for you. And yes, it's HIPAA compliant. I use it regularly when I'm on service, and I have to say, Freed is a really intuitive interface, so it really seamlessly integrated into my daily workflow and routine. I think we all have our own particular way we like to write notes, and so what's great about Freed is that it not only listens, but it also understands and adapts to your unique style over time. So the sooner you start with Freed, the easier that your day could possibly be. Give it a try and see if an AI scribe fits into your workflow. You can use the code CORE50 to get $50 off your first month of Freed. Again, use the code CORE50 to get $50 off your first month of Freed. And with that, let's get into this episode.
And I think that, again, one of the reasons I love hematology, but also found it anxiety provoking in the beginning, is you really have to get comfortable with this uncertainty.
Welcome to Core IM 5 Pearls Podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. That's Dr. Rebecca Carpley, a hematologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and one of our experts that we'll be hearing throughout this episode. I'm Dr. Marty Fried, general internist and addiction doc at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Great to be back and super excited to be working with the wonderful Sam Kumarasena.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sam, a hem-onc and palliative fellow at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Mass. In today's episode, we're zooming into what has become one of my favorite hematology topics, clotting and hypercoagulability.
Quiz yourself on the following pearls. A wise person once told me that the more you test yourself, the deeper the learning gains. Pearl 1. Reframing provoked and unprovoked venous thromboembolism.
What are some major precipitants that lead us to call a clot provoked versus unprovoked?
Pearl 2, Virchow's Triad 201.
What are the components of Virchow's Triad, and can we name several etiologies within each?
Pearl 3, protein deficiencies which cause venous clots.
Among the classic inherited thrombophilias, what are some tests that we can use to identify protein deficiencies that could cause a hypercoagulable state?
Pearl 4, activating mutations which cause venous clots.
Which tests do we use to identify clotting factor mutations which could lead to hypercoagulable states?
Pearl 5, learning point rewind and clinical application.
Stay tuned for the end, where we put this all together with a few short illustrative cases. All right, Marty, let's kick things off with the venous thrombosis categories we all know and love, provoked and unprovoked. And let's build on all the nuances from there.
As a hematologist, I like to put clots in two different buckets, really. So the first bucket would be a provoked clot. And that means we have a clear, distinct, identifiable, and oftentimes modifiable risk factor for why you had a clot. The second bucket is unprovoked. And that really means that we don't know why you had the blood clot. So I say, you know, it's idiopathic, really comes out of the blue. You're walking down the street, all of a sudden you get a blood clot, and we really don't know why. The unprovoked bucket is important because there's nothing we can really do to minimize the risk of having a clot again or to mitigate a risk factor. That risk of having a subsequent clot in some patients can be as high as 30% at 5 years. And as such, the risk of a subsequent clot likely exceeds the risk of bleeding and a blood thinner.
We typically think of anticoagulating indefinitely for the unprovoked clots. The logic behind that, while an unprovoked clot by definition doesn't have a clearly identifiable reason for the clot, the thought is that there's something underlying there that increases their risk of future clots.
And that part has always sort of made sense to me, but how often are we scratching our heads about a patient with some possible provoking factors?
Right, like someone on a road trip and they get a DVT. Like, does the car ride really explain a big PE?
So we sat down with three expert hematologists, and they encouraged us to actually reframe the provoked versus unprovoked dichotomy. They suggested that we think about reversibility, so reversible versus irreversible risk factors, meaning Does that risk factor reverse or go away with time?
Ooh, this is a new twist on an old classic. So you're saying it might be more helpful if we ask ourselves, is this risk factor temporary or reversible?
Basically, the teaching point here is that an irreversible risk factor puts us in the same bucket as a clot out of the blue. And why is that? Because in both situations, we don't think we can fix the risk factor. So the risk of clot sticks around long term, and so we should be thinking about treating long term.
Oh, all right. I like that. So let's talk about how this plays out. Say you have a patient who is unfortunately immobilized by a large territory strokes and develops a big proximal lower extremity DVT. Sure, we can identify the provoking event, immobility after stroke, but what we're suggesting here is that we should ask ourselves, is that provoking factor really going away? Should we be stopping the DOAC after 3 to 6 months? You know, in the situation of a dense infarct causing immobility, I'm not sure any of us would just say that at the 3 month mark, oh yeah, we're stopping anticoagulation, everything is fine. And this framework sort of allows for that.
Yeah, that situation, the immobility after a devastating stroke type DVT, is a good case in point. It's certainly a provoked clot, but it's due to an irreversible risk factor.
And, you know, there's probably other more common causes I can think about, for example, obesity. You know, I guess in theory it's reversible, but in practice we know that obesity can be an extremely difficult situation for our patients to reverse.
I think the issue with obesity as a risk factor is, unfortunately, you don't really know if you lose a lot of weight, what happens to your VTE risk if you lose a lot of weight. I tend to put them in the unprovoked category and make my decisions based on it because I don't think it's such an easily modifiable risk factor.
That is Dr. Ken Bauer, a hematologist at BIDMC and professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School.
Whether they've lost much weight or not, we might at least wonder about anticoagulating patients with obesity for the longer term.
And I guess that makes sense. Although who knows, maybe it'd be awesome if we can get DVT as another indication for GLP-1s in the future.
Oh man, here's hoping. Let's keep going with this and think about those cases where provoked, unprovoked sort of breaks down and where the addition of reversible, irreversible could help us out.
All right, keep going.
So really, when we talk about the paradigm breaking down, we're talking about provoked clots that are actually irreversible.
Okay, provoked but irreversible. Let's reinforce that for a second. We're thinking about reversibility here as a descriptor of your provoked clot. A provoked but reversible clot, you'll treat for the short term. This is the post-Friemer fracture DVT. In this situation, we're treating for the short term. And of course, the truly unprovoked clot with no identifiable risk factors, this is the one we're treating for life. What we're saying here is that the provoked but irreversible clot would break that mold. This might be a clot that you're also treating for the long term.
So let's think about it. What kind of scenarios belong in that provoked but irreversible bucket? We did talk about obesity before, since that's often hard to reverse, and we also talked about permanent immobility already. So here's some more food for thought. Number one, cancer. Depending on how easily it can be treated. If that cancer is progressing despite treatment, that's not really easily reversed. Number two here is anatomy. Really any cause of turbulent flow in a vessel, which might not actually be reversible. That could be a stent, a vascular malformation, or even the site of scarring from a prior venous clot. You're more likely to get a clot in that same place. Number three is inflammatory disorders. And inflammatory bowel disease is actually notorious for this. Just like we talked about with cancer, the reversibility is really dependent on whether or not you can get the disease under control. Severe rheumatologic conditions like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus also fall in this bucket, which can certainly provoke clot. And until those conditions are managed, we ought to treat them as semi-permanent conditions and treat as such.
Oh, that's fascinating. So we're saying that someone's got bad Crohn's and gets a DVT. If we're eventually able to get their IBD under control, it sounds like we can actually stop their DOAC?
You know, it's a good question, and it's sure something to think about. Or maybe bring them down to a little bit of prophylaxis or something. We'll get into that can of worms in hypercoagulability part two, so stay tuned.
Oh, I'm not going anywhere.
All right, let's do a quick summary of what we've just learned. When you think about a clot, think about whether it's provoked or unprovoked for sure. And every time you hear provoked, think about reversibility too. Is the risk factor actually reversible? Because that's really what drives our management, whether or not that risk factor is going to go away.
A provoked reversible risk factor like perioperative immobility is the classic short-term treatment. A provoked irreversible risk factor like post-stroke immobility, that's going to be one that we're probably treating for the long term.
So we talked about provoked, unprovoked, and reversible, irreversible so far. The other systematic way I find helpful in thinking about clots is thinking about the underlying mechanism driving that clot's formation, and that's Virchow's triad. I think going through the exercise of using it has made me much more thoughtful.
All right, let's remind ourselves about Virchow's triad really quick.
There are three components to developing a thrombosis: hypercoagulability, endothelial injury or vascular damage, and stasis.
That's Dr. Gene Connors, our third and final expert. Dr. Connors is a hematologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
Let's dive into that triad then with a couple nuanced examples that I didn't really think about until I got to fellowship. The first of the triad of clot drivers here is stasis. That's like a long plane ride or immobilization after an injury. That fits nicely in the stasis bucket, and those are the classics. There are some surprises here, though. You might be surprised to learn that heart failure can fit under the stasis category because reduced EF means slow flow. Recipe for thrombosis.
And we got Chef Hefref cooking up the worst in culinary clot formation.
Right. It's really any sluggish or turbulent flow that predisposes to clotting, really. Any abnormality in blood flow could fit under here. So stasis is also at play with any vascular obstruction from things like tumor or pregnancy. This bucket also includes viscosity issues, things like polycythemia, leukemia, or even specific monoclonal diseases like Waldenstrom's.
Sounds like there's lots in the stasis bucket that I didn't think about before. All right, I'm going to take a shot at the second arm of the triad, endothelial dysfunction. This one sort of feels like familiar territory. I think about atherosclerotic disease, indwelling lines, I guess stuff like that, right?
Totally. Remember that this category is more about an injury to that delicate endothelium, which exposes all that pro-clotting stuff underneath. Tissue factor, von Willebrand's, all that good stuff.
I think you and I might have slightly different ideas of good stuff. But please continue here, good doctor.
We'll have to agree to disagree there, Marty. So back to things like endothelial injury. Let's think about toxic or pokey stuff that isn't supposed to be there. That includes things like bacteremia or skin and soft tissue infections. You can even think about prior toxic exposures here, like radiation therapy, for example.
Oh, radiation therapy. See, that's good stuff, Sam. We know radiation to be sort of targeted tissue injury, hopefully localized to the cancer. But we've all seen local side effects from rashes to mucositis, and we shouldn't forget that there's a vascular territory that supplies the area that could get damaged and therefore become dysfunctional.
And another thing, remember that old scarring from prior clots also counts as endothelial injury. It's the reason why if you get another clot, you're more likely to get it in the same location as the first one.
Just clots on clots on clots.
Isn't that right? The last of Virchow's triad is hypercoagulability. That's inherent overactivation of the clotting system. We often think about the factor V Leidens of the world in this bucket.
But what most people forget is the loss of your natural anticoagulants to chronic diseases, like in cirrhosis and nephrotic syndrome. Those situations, too, can also predispose you to clots.
So far, we've talked about two frameworks here to help us think about our patients with venous clots. In Pearl 1, the reversible, irreversible idea helped us consider just how long that risk factor is hanging around. And now in Pearl 2, we've seen how Virchow's triad is helping us think about how risk factors cause clots.
All right, so how do we put these two ideas together then?
Let's roll with an example. Let's say we've got a young guy, he's 30 years old, and he gets on a plane for 12 hours, and then he gets a DVT.
So this one feels easy peasy. Using Virchow's, the airplane ride stasis, for sure, this is a provoked clot with a reversible risk factor, a temporary one. So here we're just going to anticoagulate him for the short term.
Absolutely. Now, let's make it a bit trickier. Say he was just on a plane for 3 hours and he got that DVT. Do we think about that any differently?
Air travel is an interesting one. You know, the epidemiology data is its strongest, you know, the travel distance is over 3,000 miles. So there's clearly something to the distance traveled. But in my view, it's a relatively weak risk factor. To be honest, in, let's say, a very healthy individual who develops air travel associated VTE and has no other risk factors,
I tend to actually put it more in the unprovoked bucket. I think it's such a weak risk factor that I tend to regard it as more unprovoked.
Just for context, he mentioned over 3,000 miles of air travel having the strongest data. That's about 5 to 6 hours. So over 5 to 6 hours of air travel is where it's felt to actually be a more considerable provoked risk factor.
See, now I'm kind of hard-pressed to say that it was just the 3-hour plane ride. And our homeboy is only 30 years old. I sort of get the sense that there's something else going on.
Right. You're suspecting another risk factor. Maybe an irreversible one might be hiding in there somewhere, since the plane ride doesn't seem to be enough to do it.
Which sort of begs the question if any of these have hard cutoffs. You know, for stasis, we talked about the guy who's on the plane for that indeterminate amount of time, like 4.5 hours. But for endothelial injury, what about the 2-cigarette-per-day smoker? Or the guy who had colon cancer 5 years ago and who's now considered cured? I guess I'm just wondering how we draw hard lines in the sand about using VRCAO to help us determine provoked and unprovoked, reversible versus irreversible.
We don't really have good, if you will, risk models that have been really developed. How do you draw this big divide between provoked and unprovoked and realize that it's not dichotomous?
Can I tell you how validating it is to hear a Harvard professor of medicine ask the same question that we have all asked on rounds? How do you draw that line between provoked and unprovoked? And perhaps there isn't a clear cutoff. It seems like one of those beautiful gray areas that we see all the time in medicine. And it's okay to be gray. At least that's what I keep telling my aging self.
It's like the quote we opened this episode with. Sometimes we need to get comfortable with being a little uncomfortable, and that's okay. So to summarize this pearl, when you have a new DVT or PE, think through VRCAO's triad. Is it stasis? In that bucket goes immobility or any sluggish flow with heart failure, vascular obstruction, hyperviscosity syndromes.
Is there an endothelial injury at play from bacteremia, soft tissue infections, or perhaps prior radiation?
Is it maybe hypercoagulability with inherited thrombophilias that we're going to talk about in just a second? Or is it the loss of natural anticoagulants to chronic disease like cirrhosis or nephrotic syndrome?
And we learned a quick tidbit in our application exercises that stasis with air travel becomes more at play after 5 hours or so. But even then, it's on the weaker side of risk factors. So in those situations, we still have to keep our eyes peeled for other risk factors at play.
We'll link a handy infographic in our show notes and socials. This graphic puts VRCAO's triad together with our reversibility concept, and hopefully this will help you elevate your differential for these clots.
All right, now let's turn our attention to those truly unprovoked clots. Like, we've gone through VRCAO's triad, and we're still drawing blanks. Is that when we should start thinking about factor V Leiden?
You know what? Let's talk about it. It's complicated.
All right, Sam, let's go back to our guy who sat on the plane for 3 hours and got the DVT. What do we do for him? We should probably be thinking about some underlying disorders, one of those heritable conditions. It sounds like maybe this is one of those situations where we should be throwing around those hypercoagulability tests.
You have to know what you want to do with the results and how to use the results for thrombophilia testing before you actually order the tests.
So let's get thoughtful about these tests. When we talk about the classic thrombophilia testing, for the purposes of this episode, we're really talking about testing for the inherited thrombophilias.
All right, I'm down to make some friends.
Great, let's start with some introductions. There are two groups of inherited thrombophilias, protein deficiencies and overactive factors. In the first group are the three protein deficiencies, which are deficiencies in the body's natural anticoagulants. The second group features the two overactive factors, which are clotting factors that don't turn off. So that's 5 tests in total. That's it. In this pearl here, we're going to focus on that first group, the three protein deficiencies.
Love it. So remind me, what are those conditions again?
The three classic inherited protein deficiencies that cause clots are antithrombin 3 deficiency, protein C deficiency, and protein S deficiency.
Oh boy, do I really have to remember what those guys do again?
Aw, come on, we're making friends. They might have drifted away since you first met them, but we're open to reconnecting, maybe? Maybe we'll start with what these proteins do for a living to help us understand how they cause problems when they're deficient.
All right, I'm trusting you here, Sam.
You'll be fine, Marty. Our first friend is antithrombin 3. Remember that she works alongside heparin in preventing clots. And we know heparin. We love heparin. Heparin and her low molecular weight cousins all work by increasing the activity of antithrombin 3.
Well, don't you know here? So the more antithrombin 3, less clotting. Less antithrombin 3, more clotting.
That's it. And fun fact, say you have a patient who's on a heparin drip and they're just not getting therapeutic despite massive horse doses of heparin, antithrombin 3 deficiency is actually one item on your differential in that situation.
All right, antithrombin 3. I sort of feel like I already know you. Well, pleasure to meet you again. I think I'm going to like you.
Our next two friends round out this section. They're protein C and S, and they're besties. They go everywhere together. And how do they work? These two inhibit factors 5 and 8.
Ruh-roh, Sam. I'm getting dangerously close to a clotting cascade-induced vagal episode.
Just hang on, Marty. We're almost done. This one isn't that bad. Think about it this way. Factors 5 and 8 make clot, right? And what do protein C and S do? They inhibit factors 5 and 8, making less clot. So more protein C and S means less factor 5 and 8 and less clotting. With protein C and S deficiency, factor 5 and 8 are uninhibited, and so we get more clots.
All right, so I'm sort of thinking about protein C and S as key clot defenders. And as a deficiency, we're benching those players. Without protein C or protein S, our team is liable to give up some easy DVTs. And as a Browns fan, I know a lot about crappy defense.
Oh, geez. Another pathophys fun fact here. When you start warfarin, you actually briefly create a protein C and S deficiency. That deficiency can cause two things. Number one, low protein C and S is the reason why the first few days of warfarin are associated with a paradoxically increased clotting risk. And number two, protein C and S deficiency is actually the driver behind warfarin skin necrosis. So both of these high clot situations are the direct result of warfarin creating a protein C and S deficiency for us.
All right. Well, these fellows sort of sound like decent folk. I guess that could have been worse. Possibly. You're still feeling a little presentable.
That's the spirit. Now, the thing is that this isn't all binary. For all these deficiencies, antithrombin 3, protein C, protein S, it's not just about if it's gone, but also how much functional protein is gone. We can test for the protein itself with an antigen test, as well as its activity level. And the activity level is basically a percentage of how much normal functioning you've got.
My spidey senses are tingling here. I feel like there's a catch.
Yeah, you're right on. The reason we're not sending these tests all the time is because interpreting the results can be a real headache. These tests are subject to a ton of interference.
All right, so there's actually 5 big sources of interference that we want listeners to remember that can make your patient look like they have a protein C, protein S, or antithrombin 3 deficiency. The first up...
any dose of anticoagulant will also affect these assays. So protein C, protein S, and antithrombin can be affected by the presence of any type of anticoagulant, whether it be a direct oral anticoagulant, a heparin, a bivalirudin. So it doesn't really benefit to test at that time.
Bomber. So the anticoagulant we just started is going to mess up all of our tests. It's going to make the patient look like they have a deficiency when they really don't. Fine, then. Perhaps we just test before we start the anticoagulation, right? Sounds like the problem's solved.
Antithrombin is problematic in a way that if you get a low level, even before you start any heparin, it could be affected by very large clot burden.
Yeah, that's because these factors, whether antithrombin 3, protein C, or protein S, can get consumed by trying to break down such a large clot.
So that's the second big situation that can make it look like your patient has an inherited deficiency when they do not. That's a large clot.
Yep. Even before you start anticoagulation, you can get fooled into thinking there's a deficiency when there isn't, simply related to the patient's clot burden.
And when you think about it, those are the situations when you're inclined to test patients. These are big, scary clots in young, healthy people, and we're thinking something must be awry here.
And that's a real deficiency, you know? Your patient would actually have low levels of those factors because they have a big clot. But the key is it's not an inherited deficiency. The low level is just temporary due to the size of the clot.
Yeesh. Can it get any worse?
Sure can. It's not just blood thinners and clot burden that mess up our tests. The third big reason why we should interpret these tests with caution is that you can get a false low level for the very reason why your patient might be in the hospital, often inflammation to some degree or another.
When you're inflamed, there is less free protein S available to participate in its anticoagulant effects as a cofactor with protein C. And so you actually kind of develop a hypercoagulable state. That is not persistent, right? And when the inflammation leaves, you know, you should not label your patient as being protein S deficient.
Yeah, lots of reasons to be inflamed. All right, certainly we need to be aware of that situation mucking up our tests.
Absolutely. And on to those last two conditions. And these are more specific for causing low protein C and S specifically. First up, if you see a low protein C and S, ask yourself if liver disease is playing a factor.
Yeah, that's a good point. Protein C and S are also vitamin K dependent. So when the liver goes, vitamin K dependent factors go too. That doesn't mean they've got an inherited deficiency. They just have another genuine reason to have low levels of protein C and S.
Absolutely. And the fifth one, the last big one, is estrogen.
Protein C, protein S, altered by estrogen state, right? So a lot of times I'll see women who've had a pregnancy loss at, you know, and end up with a DNE, and someone says, oh, was the pregnancy loss due to antiphospholipid syndrome? And they send these tests, and they send inherited thrombophilia tests as well. And you'll find low protein C and protein S because that's what estrogen does. Estrogen creates a hypercoagulable state by driving up the pro-coagulant protein. So fibrinogen goes up, factor VIII goes up, and protein C and protein S go down. So the acute setting may not be the time to test for activity levels.
It's pretty crazy how estrogen causes clots by creating protein C and S deficiency, even messing up fibrinogen, factor VII, and more. We're talking about lots of ways that estrogen can cause havoc.
I have three daughters, Sam. I am well aware of the havoc that estrogen can cause. But the bottom line is, it sounds like if someone's on an estrogen-containing OCP and has a clot, it's going to be really tough to interpret protein C and protein S levels.
An interesting tidbit here, the hypercoagulability in high estrogen states is actually an evolutionary adaptation to protect against bleeding during childbirth.
You're talking about a Darwin FTW?
Finch Beeks and estrogen, who would have thought? Let's do a quick recap here. Protein C, S, and antithrombin 3 can be falsely low in the following settings. Number one, any anticoagulation. Number two, large clot burden. And number three, acute inflammation. And then liver disease affects only protein C and S because they are vitamin K dependent factors, but it's still a big asterisk there, as well as high estrogen states.
Sheesh. All right, so there's lots of reasons for falsely abnormal tests, but could I at least reassure myself if we get a normal result back?
That's the thing. Normal tests aren't necessarily really reassuring, especially with DOACs and antithrombin 3. In the test tube, the DOAC will falsely act like antithrombin 3. So let's say our patient had a real antithrombin 3 deficiency, but already started on a DOAC, the test might think the DOAC is antithrombin 3, and that test will be falsely normal. Now, antithrombin 3, DOAC is the classic example, but it's true for a lot of the other tests too.
God, DOACs being the decoy themselves.
So basically, it's kind of frustrating. No matter what the level is, the test could potentially be wrong, and you won't necessarily know if it's a real deficiency or if it's a test artifact or just their physiology at the time.
Another way to look at it is that there's this whole differential diagnosis for an apparent deficiency of one of these protein tests. Imagine you've got a deficiency of, let's say, antithrombin 3. What's on your differential here? So first, this could be a true inherited deficiency that's causing their clot. That's what we're looking for here. On the other hand, a deficiency that's definitely there, but isn't actually inherited. Protein C, S, and antithrombin 3 deficiencies might be caused by some underlying disease like cirrhosis or nephrotic syndrome, or we talked about acute inflammation, high estrogen states, or maybe there's just a big clot eating up all these factors. Either way, this is a temporary but real deficiency, and it's not the cause of their clot. And then third is a fake deficiency. Something that's an artifact of how the test works in the test tube, as in, say, you're testing a patient on a heparin drip. It could look like your antithrombin 3 level is low, even when it isn't.
Exactly, Marty. I think our big picture message here is to generally avoid sending these protein tests in the acute setting. Now, of course, like everything else in medicine, this isn't black and white. There are situations where we as hematologists do send these tests in the acute setting, but it gets really nuanced and hairy real fast. So in general, if you're wondering whether this testing is relevant in a scary clot situation, ask a hematologist for help. So let's talk about the last two thrombophilia tests. These last two are the gene guys, Factor V Leiden and the prothrombin G20210A.
Just rolls off your tongue.
Sure does. They're both genetic tests for specific genetic variants that cause overactive factors. What does an overactive factor mean? Factor V Leiden and the prothrombin gene mutation lead to clotting factors becoming active due to the presence of a mutation. So this is a bit different from the other tests that we talked about before, which are generally quantitative deficiencies where you just don't have enough protein C or S or what have you.
All right, so if I had to guess here, Factor V Leiden's got to be hyperactive Factor V, and prothrombin G yada 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 has got to be hyperactive prothrombin?
Spot on.
All right, that wasn't too bad.
If you do the genetic tests, Leiden or prothrombin, those can be done any time because they're genetic on the patient's DNA. So those are no problem to do, assuming that they haven't been, you know, given blood transfusions or things that might have leukocytes in them or contaminating DNA. But those can be done any time.
At least these Factor V Leiden and prothrombin genetic tests are kind of trustworthy.
I love it when the interpretation is simple. Unless we're about to say there's a shtick with these tests as well.
I like to point out to people that currently something like 39% of the U.S. population is considered obese. And the risk, the odds ratio for getting a DVT due to obesity is about the same as for heterozygous prothrombin gene mutation. So when we're looking for what's common, obesity is a lot more common than, you know, heterozygous prothrombin gene mutation.
Naturally, it's not quite so simple. All right, so it sounds here like the issue isn't necessarily that the test results are accurate or not. It's whether or not the presence of the mutation is really what caused that clot.
The Factor V Leiden alone is often not enough. So there are some families that have Factor V Leiden mutation through multiple generations and no one has ever had a clot. And then there are some families that have Factor V Leiden mutation and many family members have had clots in their 20s, 30s, 40s.
The teaching point here is that Factor V Leiden has variable penetrance, so it affects everyone differently. Some families have it, but have no clots at all.
And I'm guessing it matters whether or not someone has one or two of these wonky alleles.
Some of these people are homozygous, and that certainly, you know, makes it even easier for you to get a clot if you're homozygous, right, compared to heterozygous. But we think that there are other either genetic modifiers or environmental factors that make Factor V Leiden behave differently from family to family. We have not been able to identify what those are.
Yes, a homozygous Factor V Leiden changes the risk of clot, but it's not common, and the causative link isn't necessarily one-to-one.
All right, fair. So what about people with a strong family history? Are those the people you test, the one who've proven themselves to be somewhat clot-prone?
The paradox in all this is just having a family history without having thrombophilia carries a risk in family members, and I think that's underappreciated. So there are studies that just having family history of VTE, so just that dad, if he didn't have Leiden, their kids would probably have had a twofold increase of VTE. So that's another reason why the controversy about thrombophilia testing stands, because even if you test negative, it still probably, the family history still should be taken account in terms of maybe how you might counsel somebody about this issue.
Then it's really the family history that we should be caring about instead.
I would say that the most important thing really is sort of biology trumps any lab test. So if you have a family where you have multiple generations of patients who are getting clots and you do all the testing and it's negative, that doesn't obviate the fact that they're all having clots.
Okay, how do I think about that family history? We know that age is a huge provoking factor. What do I make of clots in older family members?
Certainly, patients over the age of 60 who develop a DVT, they're allowed regardless of thrombophilia status.
All right, well, it sounds like we're sort of allowed a free DVT when we hit 60. Good to know.
Gee, now I've got something to look forward to. So, yes, the caveat to family history is that age itself is a provoking factor too, albeit an irreversible one. As we get older, our endothelium gets more disrupted and more thrombotic, so a first clot at the age of 60 doesn't exactly scream inherited clotting disorder. An inherited disorder usually presents earlier.
And we'll say it again. When we say family history, we're talking about more than just a DVT in grandma. We're talking about a persistent, concerning trend in relatives under the age of 60.
So it's not about the tests, really. It's kind of about how the clots actually manifest in the patient and their family. The result of the test sort of matters less.
People test to maybe explain why someone had a thrombosis, but it should not be used to guide duration of treatment. In other words, if you had your appendix out and you developed a DVT and someone tested you and you happen to have factor V Leiden, that does not mean that you need lifelong anticoagulation, right? You had a clearly surgically provoked and likely inflammation provoked as well, thrombotic event that does not need more than 3 to 6 months of anticoagulation.
I see. So all these aren't going to change much in terms of management. I'm still not sure why I'm allowed to order these tests.
But of course, the devil's in the details, and there are exceptions out there.
The only time I think it is helpful is for women of childbearing age who might use estrogen, progesterone, combination oral contraceptive pills, and possibly during pregnancy.
So that's a decision then that you will have to face, whether if you test positive, whether your children should be tested. I will oftentimes ask that question even before testing. And, you know, the concern will become if they have daughters, because they then might be affected. Let's say if dad had factor V Leiden to go start checking his daughters. What I do tell them is the issue, of course, is going to be based largely around all contraceptive use.
Wow. Okay. So it's sounding like the one caveat to our don't test vibe is that if your patient is planning a high estrogen state, and there appears to be a strong family history, this is when they might let me order those fancy tests.
Yep, for sure. Remember that a high estrogen state includes pregnancy or estrogen-containing gender-affirming care.
And the implication is that this might actually change our management, as Dr. Connor said. We might change our contraceptives to a progesterone-only formulation, or maybe even consider DVT prophylaxis during pregnancy.
Right. Because testing the parents here may not change much about their anticoagulation course as much as it helps us help their children. Honestly, a super gray area, though, and probably depends on the hematologist.
As I've found with most things, Sam, it really just comes back to it's all about my daughters.
There can be some patient-centered reasons to send testing at the appropriate time.
I think, again, the psychology of a thrombosis is also important. So I have probably a lower threshold to test, you know, maybe than other people, because I do think it helps patients sometimes understand the biology of their condition, and they understand maybe why we're more, you know, apt to continue longer term anticoagulation.
Yeah, to be honest, even in my hematology clinic, the discussions we have about testing can sometimes get controversial. So these tests, they aren't the friends we're texting on the daily, but we sure can reach out to them in a pinch.
All right, let's quickly summarize here. The gene-based tests, factor V and prothrombin, aren't affected by any of the states we talked about in Pearl 3, so that's a win, but they're still vulnerable to the big drawbacks of thrombophilia testing. Remember, if you meet a patient with factor V Leiden or prothrombin mutation in their one-liner, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be the ones getting clots. And remember, family history is probably more important than the presence of these mutations anyway. That's the core message of this pearl.
So when could you actually think about sending all those thrombophilia tests, the 3 protein factor ones and the 2 genetic tests? Number one is the standard scenario that we think about, you know, a patient with a lot of clots at a young age, no good reason for them, and a strong family history. Number two might be to consider testing in a patient with the right family history to help counsel their children, especially daughters considering OCPs in pregnancy. You're probably going to refer to a hematologist for this one. Number three, in a patient where knowing why seems really important to them, you can have a conversation about testing. But keep in mind that a negative test isn't necessarily reassuring because it doesn't negate the fact that they've had a clot.
Okay, Sam, we've covered a lot of ground in this episode. Let's put the key points together one more time.
You got it. So we've built on our framework of provoked versus unprovoked with the idea of reversibility, super important in those quote-unquote minimally provoked situations.
There are 5 inherited thrombophilia tests in total, 3 protein deficiencies and 2 overactive protein or gene tests. The 3 protein deficiencies are antithrombin 3, protein C, and protein S.
With these 3 deficiencies, you can get falsely low protein levels in a patient who's already on anticoagulation, since most anticoagulants interfere with all 3. You can also get truly low levels in a patient with a huge clot burden. A low level doesn't always mean they inherited a deficiency. For protein C and S specifically, you can get truly low levels in liver disease and high estrogen states. Doesn't mean your patient inherited a deficiency either.
The gene-based tests, factor 5 and prothrombin, can be sent off at any time. But our big picture message here is, should you? A patient with a heterozygous factor 5 Leiden or prothrombin gene mutation in their one-liner does not necessarily mean that they're definitely going to be getting clots. And family history is more important than the presence or absence of these gene-based tests.
So, with that, let's apply all this newfound clot-tastical knowledge. I have a few quick cases for you, Marty.
Let's do it.
Let's say you've got a 48-year-old guy, totally healthy, twists his ankle and spends a day or two on the couch. A week later, he has a DVT and a subsegmental PE.
I'm super interested in the Netflix that he got accomplished during that time, but go on. Please continue the case.
Honestly, you find out that his mother had a PE at age 50, totally unprovoked. And on top of that, his sister also had a PE 2 weeks postpartum at age 25. Okay. And right now, he's admitted to your service. He's inpatient. And at this point, he's already on the heparin drip. So our question here is, what should we suspect? Should we send any tests? And if so, which ones?
Ooh, okay. So this one sounds like a bit more than a simple a picks and chill situation, if you will. Let's pause here to think through how we're going to manage this binge-watching bro. Okay, so this guy is technically provoked and reversible since that provoking factor is going away. But it's a pretty weak provoking factor. I mean, who among us hasn't crushed Breaking Bad 2 in a couple days without catching a PE? And we've got this family history. I'm definitely thinking of something heritable. But he's on heparin, and so now I'm mostly limited to sending the gene tests for now, aren't I? Since the overactive factors, break protein C, protein S, and antithrombin 3, are affected by the presence of heparin. So we're thinking about sending factor 5 Leiden mutation and prothrombin G yada 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 mutation. Probably we're going to make sure he's up to date on his cancer screenings, and yeah, we're leaning towards throwing him on a DOAC and outpatient hematology for the win.
I like it. We don't expect these tests to change our immediate management inpatient, so totally fair to turf to the outpatient setting. Outpatient heme follow-up is an important bit here, because certainly if something pops up in that testing, he'd be a candidate for at least talking about long-term anticoagulation. On the other hand, if it's all negative, it could go either way, short-term, long-term. Definitely worth a discussion with hematology and the patient in terms of their risk tolerance for rethrombosis. A teaser for episode 2 here. The one exception is if you're suspecting antiphospholipid syndrome, or APLS. We'll get to APLS in the next episode, and it's a whole beast in and of itself.
Yeah, that's fair, and a good reminder to us not to forget about antiphospholipid syndrome, even when thinking about venous clots. It's a do-not-miss diagnosis for sure.
Let's think about a different situation now, all right? You're in the clinic this time. Let's say talking to a 40-year-old mom who just got a DVT-PE combo after twisting her ankle. And it's a first-time clot for her. And maybe there's less family history, maybe a DVT and a 70-year-old aunt, but nothing else. She just finished up 3 months of a DOAC. But she also has a 16-year-old daughter who's thinking about an OCP. What do you do?
Ah, the teenage daughter's throwing in some complications as per usual. Pause here, listeners, if you'd like to take some time to think about this situation. So I'm still considering this patient's clot after twisting her ankle and likely not moving much in that provoked reversible paradigm. Remember, it's still a weak factor, and I'm keeping that in mind. Her family history in this case is not very strong. At 70 years old, her aunt's risk factor was most likely her age itself, and I don't think I'd test just based on that. But my gut feeling here is I'd at least want to talk to them about testing because of her daughter. If our patient has a mutation or something possibly heritable, we'd want to avoid an OCP for the daughter. And maybe I'd have them talk to a hematologist about that in more detail.
Fortunately, she's already finished her 3 months of that DOAC, so she's off anticoagulation.
Right, so here we're also not limited to the tests that we can send. We could send them all, the gene tests and the protein tests, the protein C, protein S, antithrombin 3 deficiencies, as well as factor V Latin and prothrombin gene mutation. I'm going to sound so sophisticated the next time I consult him for a blood clot. I'm pretty amped about that.
You are going to blow them away.
And we'll finish off the episode with a word from these daughters that we've heard a lot about.
If you found this episode helpful, please share it with your team and colleagues. Give them a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really, really does help people find us.
Thank you to our viewers for this podcast. Thanks to Jerome Reyes for the audio editing and Stephen Parkin for the accompanying graphics.
Opinions expressed are Daddy's and his friends alone and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institution.
Thank you.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.